So my name's Dan Lee. I'm at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm in the electrical engineering and also the bioengineering departments there. Today, for this informal talk, I wanted to shift gears a little bit and talk more about my research, which is, not particularly in studying the brain per se, but to take some of the basic principles of how the brain does information processing and thinking about how those basic principles could apply to building artificial systems that could do interesting things. In particular, I look at kind of artificial sensory motor systems as well as in robotics. So I wanted to start off by talking about what the role of biology might be in this type of endeavor, and kind of the standard argument against why biology is useful for engineering is the typical thing that you hear is that an airplane looks nothing like a bird. And that's what people say. So why do we need to study anything about biology to build kind of interesting engineered devices? But if you actually go back in history and look at how the Wright brothers built their first flying machine, it's really quite interesting. At that time, everyone was building these ornithopters and things that, tried to fly. But one of the main problems that people encountered in flight was lateral stability of the airplane. And what the Wright brothers realized is by studying how birds flew, if you look at their notebooks, they spent hours and hours looking at birds, dissecting birds, and figuring out their wing structure. And they figured out that the way birds controlled their lateral stability was by basically tilting their wings back and forth. So they were able to, by slightly adjusting the pitch of their wings, they were able to control their lateral stability. So when they went and built their first airplane, what they did was they did exactly that. If you look at the wings of the Orville Flyer, they actually strung cables onto these wings, and the pilot would sit there and pull on these cables, and that actually warped the wings. So their airplane actually warped their wings, and that enabled the pilot to keep control of the plane to do their flight. Now, of course, if you look at a modern airplane, they don't warp the wings. What they have is they have the ailerons, and the ailerons go up and down, and that changes the shape of the wing, which is basically the same effect. But the interesting thing was that in order to build this plane, they really had to understand the basic principles of aerodynamics and how, biological animals, birds, were able to fly in order to build this first engineered device. And that is kind of interesting to see that even though, an airplane does not look anything like a bird, some of the basic, obviously the same basic principles apply. And by studying biology, they were able to gain valuable insight into building such an artificial system. So in the same way, I'm interested in thinking about some of the basic information processing architecture and algorithms that might exist in the brain, and thinking about how we can take some of those basic ideas and put them into artificial engineered systems. And a few years ago, when I was at Bell Labs, I started off by building these robots that had a bunch of sensors, cameras for the eye, for vision, microphones for audition, gyroscopes for kind of vestibular sensing, as well as a bunch of actuators to actually control what the motors of the system. And more recently in my lab, we've gotten into, actually it's now nowadays what you can do is you can just go to your corner store and buy a robot instead of having to build one yourself. And in particular, we use these Sony Aibos in the lab. And these are, if you pay about $1,500 in the US, you can get a complete robot that has built-in, built-in processor, something these days, something on the order of a 500 MIPS processor. You get, about 20 degrees of freedom in the motors. You have stereo microphones, camera, wireless built-in. So all these things are now nicely packaged in the system. The problem is really figuring out the algorithm to actually take the sensory input, figure out how to process that sensor information, and to control the motors to make it do interesting things.
What do they sell it for?
These are just entertainment robots. So in Japan, they're actually pretty big. The Japanese like these little robots. They just buy them and keep them around their house like a real pet, because in Japan, it's hard to have a real animal because go outside and have to walk it, so they don't have to do anything like that in Japan.
So are they regularly programmable, or did you have to modify them?
Sony released what they don't let you into the operating system, but they give you this SDK, it's in C++, that allows you to get the raw sensor readings and control the raw motor joints.
SDK is
Software Development Kit. So they give you, you can just download off the internet.
And it's really $1,500.
Maybe $1,700 now. So they're quite, exactly. So this is kind of, if you look at the robot, you get a whole bunch of, you get the sensors. You get a whole bunch of touch sensors on the feet. Each leg here has 3 degrees of freedom. The head has 3 more degrees of freedom, 2 degrees of freedom in the tail. There's a camera on board, CMOS camera, 2 microphones on the side of the head. And you know, you can, there's a PC card and built-in battery pack, and so you have everything.
They give you all that information?
Yeah, well, this is all, yeah, this is all readily available to program and how to access that.
Where's the PC cost?
So this version was expandable. So you actually, you didn't get it with the wireless. So you actually got a wireless card that put you stuck into the PC card to actually give you the wireless Ethernet. Oh, thanks. So just to show you some of the types of processing that we're very interested in the lab is I'm going to show you an example of some of the algorithms that we've developed to control these robots. So let me show you here. I don't know if you can hear this. So this is an example using just the microphones.
Hey, over here. Hello, over here. Hey, over here. Hello, over here.
So that's just an example of using the two binaural audition and being able to take the information coming in from the ears and being able to figure out where to control the head to move the head in the right position. Now, if you look in the kind of literature, if you look in both the signal processing literature and also in the neuroscience literature, for example, Mark Kanishi at Caltech has done a lot of work on binaural localization in barn owls. What you see is a kind of idea of how do you do this is you just basically take the signals coming from one ear, signals from the other ear, do a cross correlation in time, and look for peaks in the cross correlation, and the temporal shift then corresponds to the horizontal angle that the sound is coming from. Now, if you actually try to do that algorithm just directly on this robot, you'll find that it doesn't work at all. And the reason for that is, first of all, there's noise, right? There's noise from the motors of the robot. There's, you know, air conditioning fans going off all the time. And also, too, the microphones are pretty cheap microphones. They're not exactly, you know, the same specification. So if you just do a normal, just regular cross correlation on something like human speech with a cheap part. Yeah, I mean, is that a stereo pair?
Actually, this one not, but you can get it.
Yeah, you need to do this with two.
Yeah, sure.
But you know, they're not matched, and so if you just do regular cross correlation on regular narrow band signals like voice or something like that, then you'll find that you get peaks all over the place in the cross correlation, and it's very hard to pick out where the which is the correct source. So the algorithm that we have developed is more of a probabilistic generative model approach to it, and I don't have time to go into it today, but instead of using cross-correlation, it does a deconvolution, and it uses what I'll show you is non-negativity constraints in doing this deconvolution to basically give you very nice peak structure in figuring out the time delays associated with the different sound sources. But so that's just an example of some type of sensory processing we're interested in on these types of robots. Now, on the motor side of things, we're also interested in what kind of algorithms are needed to control all these degrees of freedom that these robots contain. So this is an example of some of the types of gates and things that we've developed for this robot. So this just shows the robot, you know, developing, making it go forward, backwards, in fact, and turning. In fact, we can make it do any type of omnidirectional motion, so that's a sidestep. But then also, too, we've done some more complex types of behaviors with this. So here, we show here, we can do a backflip with the robot. And not only can he do back, we can actually walk upside down here. And then not only this walk, there's another step here, and then we can also have the robot flip around. So the interesting thing about this is we showed this to Sony. And Sony didn't even know that their robot could do this. And the reason for this is, you know, the actual control of figuring out where all the muscles, what all the motors have to do in order to do these kinds of very complex behaviors, no one has figured out how to do that yet. And so by developing this, you can show that even with this kind of relatively cheap hardware, by actually figuring out how to, you know, how do we optimize, how do we learn these types of behaviors in a readily accessible manner, then we can get these things to do kind of interesting things without having to build huge hardware devices.
Then why is he walking on his forearms?
I'll show you that in 1 second.
But so this is, you programmed it to do exactly this. It's not adapting to whatever it's working on and things like this, is it?
Yeah, no, this is actually learned to, I'll show you, I'll talk a little bit about later, but the walk pattern is especially, is actually optimized. It's using this very simple reinforcement learning scheme to actually do as fast of a walk as possible. So I'll show you the, obstacles? Okay, so let me get to the next part here. So one interesting thing that we do with these is we actually participate in a robot soccer competition. And this is every year what happens is there's something called a RoboCup League. And there's different leagues, and we're in this thing called the Legged League because we use these four-legged robots. Other leagues have, you know, there's a bigger kind of robot league where you build your own robots about this big. There's a small league where you build small robots this big. And then there's other, you know, simulation and things like that. But in this league, you play four-on-four soccer, and they're completely autonomous. This is unlike, you know, remote control robot, you know, battle bots that you see on TV. But this is so, once you program these things to figure out, you know, take in information from the camera, from sound, from any kind of any type of sensors, and then to figure out how to walk and move and to kick the ball, these things are now playing four-on-four autonomous soccer with each other. And you know, the way they set this up is it's just like the World Cup of, you know, whatever, robot soccer. Every, you know, there's different teams from Australia, from US, Europe, South America. And then you get together, you play pool play, and then you play quarterfinal elimination matches, and then you go to semifinals. And there's two halves. You switch sides at each half. You have uniforms that you got to dress these dogs in and switch the colors at halftime. So, you have a question?
Can you change hardware, or is it only software?
In this league, the nice thing about this league is that the hardware is fixed. Everyone uses these dogs. And so it's all in how you actually, you know, process the information and do stuff. So in other leagues, it's a little bit different because you can make your own hardware. So a good example is in the middle-sized league, one team came up with this kicking mechanism for the ball. And the way they built this hardware mechanism was it had this pneumatic, you know, piston basically that took like 10 seconds to charge up the piston. And then when they got the ball, they could shoot this ball like 30 miles per hour. It was like a cannon out there on the field. So their whole strategy all was that the robot would get to the ball, and then you'd grab the ball, and just, it was like a tank. It would just kind of slowly turn towards the goal, find an opening in the goal, and this thing would come firing out at 30 miles per hour. And so in that sense, it's not so interesting from our perspective because it doesn't show any kind of intelligence or learning. Just, you know, you just have this cannon that's going to basically fire away. So this league is fixed hardware. Everyone uses the same sensors. Everyone uses the same motors. But then it's all in how you actually program these.
Now you have the, you know, now it's social insect kind of problem, this community intelligence problem, in addition to the issues about a single.
Yeah, it's single, and then plus these is collaborative kinds of effects. How do you play teams? And so I'll show you how, you know, example of what this looks like. So this is this was last summer. So this is in Italy, so that's why there's an Italian play-by-play announcer. But so this is our team here, and that's the ball in the middle of the field, and this is a kickoff. And this is the championship map. And we mess up our kickoff there. Our kick didn't come off. So you can say this team actually plays more like rugby instead of soccer. Their strategy is they get all their dogs behind the ball, and they push this ball, just ram it past your goalkeeper. That's the way they try to play. So that's your defender. And he gets turned around. And now this guy is getting this ball. And you see our goalkeeper is a little too far back in the goal, but he'll come out at the right time here. He comes out, he grabs the ball, he does a kick, and then we have our guy positioned out here to get this kind of pass, and then he's able to turn around, and he shoots another kick sideways, and that, you know, we get that roll to get into the goal. So that's what this soccer is. We actually scored quite a bit like this, but not from half court. That was unusual to get that far away. But you know,
so star goalie. Huh?
Well, their goalie was okay in that match. But I mean, it's kind of interesting. About 3 years ago, if you looked at this kind of robot soccer, it was more like four or five-year-old soccer. The ball would go in the corner, and you'd have all, you know, seven, eight robots chase this ball in the corner, and they just basically would get stuck on each other. And then, you know, accidentally the ball would come across, and they would all chase it into the next corner. And half of them didn't know where they were on the field, so half the shots would be either on your own goal or on their goal. So, I mean, it's really a hard problem. The only information really that the dog has about the field is he has a very limited field of view coming from the camera, and from that he has to deduce where he is on the field, where the ball is, where he should go compared to all his teammates, and how to avoid the other players to actually get to try to score the goal. So it's really, and you have to do this at a very high speed, otherwise the other team will basically take the ball from you and come back the other way. So it's really this kind of real-time processing constraints that come into play that, you know, are, I think, exactly what we do when we are able to do this kind of processing from what we see from our eyes and do our behaviors. Okay, so what I wanted to do was talk about how I think biology can make an impact on some of these problems and how we can develop algorithms for this type of interesting types of sensory motor behaviors. And in robotics, what they do is they typically, you know, just like I think in neuroscience, these kind of split, you know, the different aspects of this processing into perception, the sensory side of things, into the motor, the actuation side of things, and then somewhere in the middle here, you have some kind of high-level processing that you stick together. And in the same way, robotics people will do the same kind of division of labor in this type of information processing flow. So what I would like to do is talk a little bit about where I see kind of biological inspiration coming into new algorithms for sensory processing, some new algorithms for motor processing, and then thinking about how we can combine these two to give you kind of a nice principal way of thinking about sensory motor types of tasks. Okay, so first on the sensory side of things, let me just give you an example of what the robot does when it plays soccer. So in this case, this is what basically the robot sees in an image frame. And what you have to do is your robot has to process this at 25 or 30 frames per second. Otherwise, if you lose a frame, you're losing information. So you have to really keep up with the speed of this visual information coming in. So the way the algorithm works to make it fast is we do color segmentation. So this is why, in some sense, it's a cheat. We have, you know, the ball is orange. The goal, you know, one goal is yellow, the other goal is blue. That's the way you know which goal you're going against. And then the field itself is green with white lines. So what happens is, one, you know, we do a color segmentation where, you know, all the green of the field is labeled, the yellow of the goal is labeled, and then there's a couple, you know, corner beacons with this kind of, you know, two colors stuck together. That makes it very easy to see these corner mark positions. And based upon this, we can, you know, have the robot deduce where it is on the field, given the head angle of its camera and given its stance, and, you know, given basically from the geometry of this of where these objects are. And the most important thing is, of course, the ball. Now, all that the robot is doing is finding an orange, basically, circle, a filled orange circle, of orange blob, and then taking the centroid of that position and projecting that onto the ground plane to figure out where the ball is on the field. So kind of the information reduction here for robot soccer is you're taking a very complicated set of pixels here. I mean, if I think of this color image, you know, a 240 by 320 kind of color image, you have, you know, three numbers for each position. And you're really, if you just want the ball position, you're taking this huge set of numbers here and reducing it just to kind of an XY coordinate on the field. So kind of just the variability here is that this ball could be anywhere in your image, and also too, you have to take into account your head angles and kind of where you are, and you're just trying to deduce from this, just if you're doing it deterministically, you're just determining the XY coordinate of the ball, and if you're being a little bit more sophisticated, you write down some probabilistic model of where the ball might be as some kind of Gaussian in these XY coordinates.
Wait, so you know where you are because you've been integrating your whole path as you go?
Yeah, so I'm not going to talk about this, but localization of the robot is a very important thing. And what you do is you are use both your visual information. I've seen this yellow goal, I've seen that corner beacon. But if you think about it, if I just see the goal, then that doesn't tell me where I am on the field. Because, you know, given my head angle, I could be anywhere, you know, I could see the goal anywhere on some arc. So you need to integrate both where different objects are, and also, too, you have to take into account your motion. So so the probabilistic model that we use takes into account that we're moving and tries to estimate how far we've moved, as well as kind of what you see visually. But of course, it becomes an even harder problem in this soccer because we have penalties. Okay, so what happens in a penalty is that we have penalties like ball holding or basically obstructing another robot. A human referee comes in, picks up the robot, takes him off the field, puts him in a penalty area, and then after the penalty's done, sticks him somewhere randomly in the middle of the field. So this is in the robotics, it's called the kidnapped robot problem. And so it's like, you know, some entity has just come in and just teleported you somewhere without you knowing about it. So the algorithms that are developed for this have to take this into account. So it's a pretty complicated thing to do this properly.
In order to localize yourself, for example, you could turn your head to get other reference points, for example, the corner or...
So
it decides whether he has to turn his head to...
Yeah, so we used to do this a couple years ago. We would, every now and then, you'd stop and you'd sit there and go like this and look for things. So you try to see different markers and the goal, and that would give you a good lock. But every time you do that, the ball is going by you and someone else is pushing. So what we're doing is trying to get this to work. Basically, we're just tracking the ball and trying to chase the ball and get in the right position relative to the ball and not worrying so much about trying to localize and just hoping that enough kind of auxiliary information is coming in through the camera and that we're integrating everything properly to give us that. Because otherwise, I mean, there's this trade-off. You can, you know, stop and be sure about things, but that's going to affect your overall behavior.
Do you do time integration? For example, if you know the position at a certain time is zero,
yeah,
and you're speed and you think you should,
yeah,
compute.
Sure. So what happens is we do it all within a probabilistic model. So at each instant in time, the robot has a probabilistic, the simplest thing that people use is these Kalman filters, which is you have a Gaussian distribution of where you might be on the field. So what you do is, in time, if you step, what you'll do is you'll kind of, it's like diffusion. You move this Gaussian distribution in a little bit, and you also kind of diffuse it out because you have noise in how you move. And one of the hardest things is that you might be your arm might be stuck against the wall, so you think you're moving, but you're not really moving. So you have to take into account all these effects when you do this kind of localization. So it's really a hard problem to do this properly. Okay, so on the perceptual side of things, the thing I want to point out is just like we take a big color image with a lot of pixels in it, and we're just really trying to extract out the ball position. In general image processing, we have the same problem. We have, you know, an image, and we can think of each of these pixels as being some number, and I can think of this image as being some big vector. And I can think of then the space of images as just some big high-dimensional Euclidean space that contains all these different points, each one corresponding to an image. Okay, so this is something that Sebastian Sung and I have been interested in, is kind of the variability in images can be characterized by different modes here. So imagine that I take an image. This is old. You can see this is Bush and Gore, so I should update this for the new election. But, you know, if I take the image of George Bush here, and I do some very slight rotation, each of these images corresponds to some point in this high-dimensional space. And so what makes recognition very hard to do is that when you are recognizing this picture as George Bush, you're not recognizing a single point. What you're really recognizing is that all rotations have this kind of, you know, some kind of curvilinear structure in this space of images. And if I considered rotations, scaling, translation, you know, zoom, all these effects will then translate into some kind of some small set of degrees of freedom where this image moves around in this image space. So one of the questions we were interested in is, you know, what's a good way computationally to handle this type of variability in the, say, space of images? Okay, so kind of just to review kind of what the basic computer vision people do for this problem is, you know, what you do is you start with some kind of data set. So you want to do some kind of learning algorithm where you're taking data and you want to learn kind of variability in images without having to pre-specify yourself, you know, do this kind of operations on the set of images. So given a set of images, I can think of this as a big matrix. You know, each image each pixel here is some coefficient here. And so each column is one image. And then I have some set of images, so I just stack these columns together, and then I'll have a matrix, a big two-dimensional matrix. Now, you can write down some kind of graphical model that tries to explain the variability of these different coefficients in terms of some what's known as some set of kind of hidden nodes here in this graphical model. But the easiest way to think about a simple algorithm for handling this type of data is just think about factorizing it. So I have a big matrix here, and I want to write it as a product of two other matrices. And one of these matrices would correspond to something like these weights between this layer and this layer. And the other matrix would correspond to the actual activations of these nodes in this graphical model. So, but just from a linear algebra point of view, I'm just taking a matrix and I want to think about factorizing it.
Why does that transformation have to be linear?
It doesn't have to be linear. So I'm showing you here. So the simplest thing to do is consider it as a linear transform. And so here what you would do is you have your big matrix, and I want to find we want to find the best approximate factorization of this matrix and find the coefficients here, W and the coefficients V, such that this matrix product is as close to the original matrix as possible. So you can think about this as an optimization over the Frobenius norm of the original matrix. With the difference between that original matrix and your product, and you're now optimizing over these two matrices. Now, if you just write down simple orthogonality constraints, this is equivalent to just taking the singular value decomposition of your original matrix. Okay, and so this is the way you would do is you take the covariance, you take the correlations in this, and then take the take the eigenvalues and eigenvectors, and take the eigenvectors with the largest eigenvalues.
What if you have this L squared or Euclidean type norm instead of this as your object, as your function? Does that change actually?
This is L2. This is Euclidean.
So I mean squared. So more Euclidean sort of distance measure rather than doing absolute. You're doing minimum of the absolute.
No. This is squared error. If you do some other thing, then it won't be this nice kind of spectral decomposition. You'll have to do some other nonlinear optimization. Okay, so if you take, say, a set of database of faces, and you do this decomposition, you get what's known in the computer vision literature is known as eigenfaces, for obvious reasons. And the way this works is this is the top 49 eigenfaces for this database of faces that we had. So the way this works is the red coefficients, the red pixels here indicate a negative value, the black pixels indicate some positive value, and white is something near zero. And so this is an orthogonal basis that each of these things are orthogonal to each other. And these are coefficients here. So given this face image, I can take this basis, and by taking the black, so I'm here taking this plus this minus that minus that minus that minus that plus this minus that minus that. And so if you take this linear combination of these basis vectors, you'll end up with a reconstructed face which is as close as possible to this original image. Okay, so this is what this eigenface decomposition does. It discovers a basis, an orthogonal basis, which by taking linear combinations of these bases give you a reconstructed image that's as close as possible in this L2 norm to the original image. Now, another kind of standard computer vision algorithm is, instead of doing principal components analysis, is to do vector quantization. And you can think of vector quantization as doing a matrix factorization, but with different constraints. Instead of orthogonality constraints, you do this matrix decomposition with this kind of winner-take-all constraint, where the coefficients are all constrained to have zeros except for one, one somewhere in each of these columns. Okay? And the way, if you do this on the set of faces, this is what you get. You get what are these kind of prototypical faces. And so given this original face, what you do is you find kind of in the set of these prototypes, you find the one that looks closest to this original one, and then you just replicate that particular prototype. Okay. So this is all kind of older work, so I'm going to go quickly on this.
And all those faces are seen head on, is that right?
Yeah, these ones here are just all head on. So kind of the way we looked at this, problem was then you can think of these two very different algorithms, principal components analysis and vector quantization, as both taking just some big matrix and factorizing as a product of two other matrices with different constraints. In principal components analysis, you have this kind of orthogonality constraint, and in vector quantization, you have this very hard type of, you know, only one coefficient can be on at one time. So we get two very different representations. One is this kind of in principal components analysis, you get this very distributed basis, but it's very hard to understand what each of these basis images is doing in the reconstruction. And in vector quantization, you get this extremely sparse representation. You're only allowed to use one thing at a time. So then, this is work with Sebastian Sung 4 years ago. We looked at kind of, well, what can biology maybe say about this type of algorithms? And, you know, of course, in neurons, you have, you know, action potentials. And the simplest possible code that you could think of is just think about firing rates, which have a nice natural constraint that you have the firing rate is either zero or have some positive value. You don't have negative activations. And that the synapses between neurons are constrained by Dale's law to be either excitatory or inhibitory. So the inspiration from biology was then you have these kind of very simple-minded, kind of one-sided constraints on the synapses as well as activations. Maybe that might have something to say about these types of machine learning types of models. And here then we just took our graphical model and constrained these weights to be excitatory and constrained these activations to be all non-negative. And so then we write down an optimization problem, which is, again, just a factorization of this original matrix X as a product of two other matrices, but under the constraint that each of these coefficients of these two matrices have to be non-negative. So you're taking a non-negative matrix and decomposing as a product of two other non-negative matrices. And to do this kind of optimization, you know, the one of the standard algorithms that you would do is gradient descent. So in gradient descent, I take the derivatives of this objective function, and these are the derivatives. And then typically what you would do is you'd, you know, take your gradients, you multiply by some small parameter, and then, you know, kind of do gradient descent. Well, it turns out that instead of doing this kind of additive gradient descent, if you look at this gradient, each of these gradients consists of two terms, one positive and one negative. If you actually take these two terms of the gradient, and instead of, you know, doing this gradient descent, if I take the positive term, put it in the denominator, and take this negative term, and make it a positive numerator and just create a ratio out of it, then what we can do is we can define an algorithm which is a multiplicative type of update. Instead of this additive gradient, you just take the two parts of these gradients and make them into a multiplicative ratio. And we found that this algorithm then is guaranteed to converge monotonically to the optimum value of this problem. And the way you can show this, the proof of this kind of convergence is based upon something in machine learning uses something called the expectation maximization algorithm, uses this type of approach to prove convergence. And the way this works is you're trying to minimize some kind of overall function f, and you have some estimate of where the minimum is. What you do is you construct something known as an auxiliary function, which is an upper bound, which goes through that point. Now, this auxiliary function, since you can construct it, hopefully you can make it so that you can get to the minimum of this exactly. And by getting to this minimum, then you're guaranteed to go downhill on the original function. And by iterating this over and over, you'll have monotonic convergence towards your minimum value of your original function. Okay. So unlike gradient descent, where in gradient descent you have this parameter, right? If this learning rate parameter, if you make that parameter too large, what can happen to your gradient optimization is that you can flip-flop. And so by having that too large, you'll not be able to get to the minimum value. But if you have it too small, then your convergence rate is very, very tiny, extremely slow. Now, what we've shown is that this multiplicative update rule has no adjustable parameters and is guaranteed to converge to this kind of monotonic optimization without you having to play with this kind of parameters.
So this is in a non-negativity condition is a constraint. So is it obvious that you only have one minimum there? I mean, can't you get stuck in a local minimum?
So with one of these matrices fixed, then you have a convex optimization problem, so you can't get stuck in a local minimum. But since we're iterating over both of these, then you can actually have a couple different local minimums. But you're guaranteed to go to one of these minimums.
One of the local minimums.
Yeah. In general, if you have a very hard non-convex problem, you're never guaranteed to go to the global minimum. So yeah, we don't have that guarantee, but we have a guarantee that each iteration of this very simple racial multiplication is guaranteed to decrease your value, and so ultimately you have to get to a local.
Do multiple restarts? Or?
So yeah, so we just do restarts and see if there's any qualitative differences. So this is what this rule looks like. So this is random initialized basis with this non-negative factorization. This is the iteration number of this multiplicative rule, and you're guaranteed that this reconstruction is getting better and better over time at each iteration. And so quickly you see that this basis is starting to converge towards something which, if you do another restart, looks very qualitatively similar to this. So this is the that's the algorithm in practice. And so this is what you end up with. And what we were interested in is that this is quite qualitatively different than what you get with principal components or with vector quantization. What you get is each of these things, you get something that looks very sparse in locality here without having to build that in. And then you have some sparse coefficients here, which, together, take something what we would call something like you have some eyes here, and you're combining that with, some part of a nose here, an eyebrow here, part of a mouth. And by putting these parts together, you would get something that looks like this, that is close to what you originally had. So that was the algorithm.
So just to place it in the overall framework, I mean, there is an infinite number of optimization problems that I could come up with, which would minimize some sort of a function of this two matrices.
Yeah.
And I mean, people are trying other ones. I mean, these are the only three that.
No,
are
no,
available.
I'm.
Or like, what's.
No, the, okay, yeah, you're right. I mean.
General state of the field.
Yeah, so there's, if you're if you know this literature, then there's independent components analysis. There's lots of variations that are on all these types of different, using different types of orthogonality constraints or using higher order statistics instead of looking at pairwise correlations. You look at quartic terms and things like that to do your independent components analysis. This, I mean, the reason why we were interested in this was just kind of a very simple kind of non-linearity, this kind of non-negativity, which, perhaps in biology is kind of a fundamental issue, is that with rates or with synapses.
On and off neurons.
Well, okay, some other groups have taken this and actually done on and off. What you do is if you really want to do that, you model it with non-negative you model it with non-negative units, one representing on cells, one representing off cells, and then you can build up things that look more like complex cells and things like that. So there's an infinite things that you can start to do with this. The point of this was just to say kind of some very simple non-linearity like this one-sided type of constraint can have quite dramatic qualitative effects on a very simple type of learning algorithm. And just to put it in the context of what people typically do with principal components analysis or with vector quantization, just by using a different constraint, you get something that's interesting. And that was kind of the purpose of this. And people have now, taken this, combined it with more, more things like a sparsity control and things like that to get interesting types of features.
Just one more question.
Sure.
The nonlinearity as asking about is actually also a slightly different one. So when you wrote x equals vw, you could have written x is a function of v and w, not necessarily a product. And in fact, when I think about the natural scenes, there is such effect as occlusion, which cannot be represented in a linear form.
Yeah. So the simplest Bell-Sinofsky independent components analysis is this. What you do is you write x is equal to kind of point-wise nonlinearity of this w times v. And then you optimize over your basis and you optimize over coefficients, taking into account a very simple point-wise nonlinearity. So if you look at, if you're interested in...
It still wouldn't take care of occlusion.
Okay, so for occlusions, I mean, if you want to explicitly model that, So there's other models which are kind of very generative models. So what you try to do is you try to model the exact image formation process. It's almost in some sense inverse computer graphics. What you do is you write down kind of that you have some generative process that puts down objects and you get some perspective of that, and then you try to then optimize over some parameters of this generative process. So, but no one can do that in kind of a nice way at this point. So what you do is you try to write down models that kind of give you algorithms that you can actually run on fairly large data sets and are fairly efficient.
Just one question.
Yeah.
Here, what you want to do at the end, I mean, it depends what you want to do. Because, I mean, the general thing, the vision problem is complicated.
Yeah, I'm...
Here, you want just to locate or the ball or something?
No,
so you don't have to solve the general problem.
No, okay, so the ball example was just to say that kind of, this is a reduced, I mean, if you think about the space of these images, right, you're working starting off in, say, you know, several hundred dimensions and you have thousands of images, okay? This is now kind of taking it down into 49 coefficients which represent these different types of images very efficiently. So it's a dimensionality reduction. That's what we're interested in. And so the ball example is just an extreme form of that. If I'm a robot dog, I'm taking in all these pixels, I'm really just interested in two numbers. Where is the ball? X, Y of the ball. Okay, so in that sense, that's a very extreme dimensionality reduction. I'm showing here a more generic types of algorithms which do that automatically.
Yeah, so you use color to do ball detection. You don't apply this to the...
No, we don't do this on the ball. So the ball is, up to now, most people are just handcrafting some, you know, thing. What you do is you do the color segmentation, you do blobs, connected regions, then you take centroids and you do tests on the circularity of the ball. And so there's all these kind of handcrafted things that people do.
Okay. Just one question. I didn't understand whether you said that the sparseness is a feature of the procedure. Is it just because you're showing faces that have, you know, two eyes, one nose, and one mouth that are of the same scale, and you just get as sparse as that scale allows?
Yeah. So the sparseness here comes about because we have this constraint that things can't go below zero. So naturally, when you do an optimization with constraints, a lot of things hit the constraint. So here, what's happening is a lot of things hit the constraint, which is zero, which is a nice kind of sparseness built in.
But okay. If you had shown pictures with many more scales, spatial scales, then you wouldn't see any sparseness.
No one has a generic algorithm where you can take just generic images and suddenly it's going to come up with kind of all the objects and all the parts of all these. There's no algorithm that exists that can do that. So like, even the, you know, if you look at the literature, independent components analysis, all these other types of image features, extraction, all do things like this, where they assume that you kind of regularize some of the image set.
Sorry, can I just ask, why do you want all of the synapses to be excitatory?
Well, okay, so in this model, it was just a very simple model that the that kind of this generative model, that is taking the hidden features, these unknown features, and generating what you're seeing is excitatory. But actually, if you write down the complete network model to do the optimization, then what you have is you have local inhibitory kind of inhibition as well. So the generative model is just an excitatory kind of model. Okay. So now I want to kind of come up to more recent algorithms in machine learning that might be appropriate to think about in terms of the brain, and that is learning in general, kind of general nonlinear manifolds embedded in high dimensional spaces. So as I showed you, kind of these images, you can think of as low dimensional manifolds that are embedded in some kind of high dimensional pixel space. And these degrees of freedom of this low dimensionality is due to things like translation, rotations, scaling. These types of things are giving you these invariances that give rise to these types of structures. So in the machine learning community, there's been kind of a lot of recent work on coming up with generic data processing algorithms that can automatically discover some of these types of features. So let me give you a flavor of how those work. So in particular, there's one algorithm called locally linear embedding. And the way this works is you're given kind of points in some high dimensional feature space, some high dimensional vector space. And what you do is you induce some local graph structure on these points. And what you do is, you know, you construct nearest neighbors of different points on this these set of points. And then you do this quadratic optimization, which is given all your data points and given this local graph structure to it, you optimize these reconstruction coefficients, W. And now given these W's, you figure out what a low dimensional representation of these points are by doing this quadratic optimization. So by just doing two simple quadratic optimizations, which you can write down as an eigenvector problems, you can induce, what you do is you can take a nonlinear manifold, a low dimensional nonlinear manifold that's embedded in a high dimensional space, and now reconstruct a low dimensional representation of that manifold, some kind of, you know, a parameterization of that manifold in a low dimensional space. And that's what a lot of recent algorithms have been focused on trying to do.
Is there a way to understand the dimensionality of the problem?
So there's some newer algorithms where So unfortunately, the spectrum of these kinds of eigenvalues don't give you a good handle of how many dimensions I should do. But some newer algorithms actually do give you a good estimate of the dimensionality that you should be using. So this just recently, I can give you some references if you want.
Ben, I don't know if you know, but there is no 1 hour limit on this talk.
Okay.
Except for the plane.
Except for my flight, yeah. I probably should leave before noon, so I should try to.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is an example of using LLE to do this. What this data set is a picture of a face that's translated in a larger image. And so each of these images, you can think of some point in some thousand-dimensional vector space. And just given this set of images, by using this algorithm to reconstruct a low-dimensional representation of these things, you actually get a two-dimensional representation that now shows the kind of translational symmetry structure of these images automatically. So there's nothing built in. So what happens here is, you know, this point represents upper left, this point represents upper right, this point in the middle here represent pictures of the face in the middle of the image, and this point represents a picture towards the bottom corner. So this shows the geometry of this kind of translational degrees of freedom of this set of images automatically learned by this procedure. Okay, so these are some of the kinds of interesting algorithms that, you know, you can think about, you know, how biology does some of these computations. At this point, I also want to look at the kind of the motor side of things, the action side of robotics. And this is just a picture of an interesting robot that, you know, Mark Raber built while he was at MIT. And what he had done was he used a very simple controller to actuate this pneumatic piston so that this thing could hop back and forth. So it's kind of you think of hopping as kind of a very complex behavior, but a single actuator like this and a rotation, he was able to do this very effectively. So kind of the traditional way this is done in robotics is to do motor control. What you do is in robotics, like a robot like this, a robot arm, what you do is you model this completely. What you do is you know exactly, you know this length, you know this length, you know this length, you know kind of the torques on this motor, you know the torques on this motor. You have, you know, measurements of this angle, and you write down some kinematical model that, you know, describes exactly the the kinematics of, you know, if I move these angles exactly where my hand goes. And then what you do is you write down some dynamical model that says, okay, how do I get to the right joints here, joint angles in terms of the torques on the motors. And so you have this very complicated kind of physical model of the world, basically, based upon your actuators. And you need to know exact information about all the lengths of your arm. And what you then do is you try to figure out how to optimize the actual controls for this, all these joint angles, so that your hand goes in the right place. So this is kind of the traditional way that you would do kind of robotic motor control. Now, let's take a look at kind of how biological motor control might possibly work. And, you know, one simple system for motor control is an ocular motor system, where you have different muscles activating, you know, say, the different degrees of freedom of where, say, an eye is looking. And, you know, this is work that was done in collaboration with David Tank and Sebastian Sung. And this is, they studied the goldfish system, where you have a neural integrator. You have an area in the goldfish brain called the neural integrator, which is responsible for kind of high-level control of where the fish is looking. So let me just skip that. So kind of the basic idea there was that, you know, you're trying to control all these muscle fibers in the fish eye, in the fish ocular motor system. But really, there's kind of an underlying simplification to this problem. That is, let's just think about looking in a horizontal plane. And so really, you only have one degree of freedom, that you want the eye to look left, center, or right with any kind of continuum between there. And so the idea is that if I look at kind of the firing rates of all the eye muscles, of all the different muscle fibers of the eye, it's going to be in a high-dimensional space, that all the activations I can think of as embedded in some very high-dimensional space. But really, there's only a small set of controls that you're interested in, which is kind of this one-dimensional degree of freedom. So the idea that Sebastian and David Tank were working on was looking at kind of this line attractor structure that exists in this very high-dimensional space. That is, in the space of all the different firing rates of all these different neurons, there really is kind of a one-dimensional set which is really that's the interesting object, which corresponds to the one-dimensional angle that the fish is looking at. So again, we see that kind of on the motor side of things, you seem like you have all these kind of degrees of freedom, but really there's kind of an underlying dimensionality reduction that's important. In the ocular motor system, it's just kind of where the eye is looking, even though you're controlling all these different muscle fibers. And what we've looked at is in legged locomotion, you also have the same problem. So to control where these robots are walking, these robot dog robots that I showed you, what we have to do is we have to control 12 different actuators in time. And so what we have is for each leg, there's three different joints. And so you have 12 total. And the controller that's built into the robot, you have to send joint angles to the different motors every 8 milliseconds. So if you think about that, that's a huge number of parameters. You can send 12 kind of joint angles every 8 milliseconds. So to generate something like a 1 second, 2 second walk cycle, that's on the order of thousands of joint angles that you're sending to the dog. But really what's happening is that you're simplifying the problem. And the reason, one way it's gross simplification is that the gait of the dog is important. So a gait is just kind of controlling how the different legs are tied together in time, right? So for instance, what we use is we use a trot pace, which is that the front right leg and the back left leg kind of are doing the same thing, right? So these two step at the same time, lift up and step at the same time, and the front left and the back right step at the same time. Now, if you look at other types of four-legged animals, there's many different ways of tying together these different degrees of freedom, and these are the different gaits. So there's a crawl gait, where in time, you know, one leg picks up, then another leg picks up, then another leg picks up, and another leg picks up. This trot gait, what we do is we pick up two legs at the same time, and then two other legs at the next instant in time. And there's a pace gait, which is interesting if you kind of know horse shows, the way horses walk, and horses in the wild don't naturally walk this way, but when the trainers get them to perform in a horse show, they actually make them learn a different way of walking, which is this pace. And that typically is they pick up their front right and their back right at the same time, and then they pick up their front left and their back left at the same time. So this is supposed to look a little bit more regal when they walk around, you know, prance around the arena, but this is not a natural walk for them. So for camels, perhaps, yeah, but not for horses. So there's also two different species, too, of different, you know, these certain camels that do it and certain camels that don't do it. So it might depend on African versus Asian camels, right? No? Okay. So if you think about gaits, one simple way of understanding what a gait does for you is it simplifies the problem. Instead of having to control 12 different degrees of freedom independently in time, you're controlling a smaller set because you're tying together these different degrees of freedom. Now, another way what we've done for learning this walk is we've also reduced the problem even further. And what we've done is we've modeled what each leg does as just a simple kind of a rectangular locus of what the foot is doing. So what we do is we model the walking of the robot dog as just that the foot is kind of doing a rectangle in space. And so what happens is it picks up its foot, kind of recovers here, puts it down, and then when it's going like this, it's propelling the body forward. So even though each of these different instants of time is a set of three different joint angles, really now this parameterization has made it even more reduced, because all you need to parameterize this by is kind of the length of this, the height of this, and kind of the relative location of the shoulder. So instead of having multiple joint angles going off in time, you just have a smaller set of parameters here which characterizes this locus. So now what you've done is taken this kind of high dimensional space of motors that the robot needs to perform and reduced it down into just picking the right gait and then picking these parameters of this walk locus, and then by taking a simple optimization, this kind of policy gradient reinforcement learning approach to it, you can now optimize these parameters to actually give you as fast of a walk as possible. And this, of course, is important in soccer, because if you're going 50% faster than your opponents, you're good. No matter how badly you shoot, you can basically beat them to the ball all the time. So, you know, things like walking fast and being able to turn fast and maneuver are very important. So what we use is we use this kind of reinforcement learning to optimize these parameters. Okay, so now I want to get to how can we connect maybe some of these sensory perception issues to how we do motor control. And that's, you know, generically, how do we do behavior? Now, in the robot soccer domain, and this is kind of most of all of robotics, the way you do kind of this high-level control is to just write down some kind of finite state machine. What you do is, you know, you have different modes, like, you know, search for ball. That's when, you know, he's taking his head and looking around to find the ball. Once he sees the ball somewhere, he's just going to go to the ball so that the legs are just kind of moving to kind of directly go right towards where the ball is. And once he gets the ball, if he grabs the ball, then he can kick, do some kind of kick behavior. And so this is kind of, if you look at kind of artificial intelligence for robotics or even artificial intelligence for like computer games, this is basically what everyone does at this level, is to write down some diagram like this of what different things you would do depending upon what you see.
So if the ball is not in front of you but over there, then would it go straight and then make a decision to go left? And also the other question is, are there many different kinds of kicks?
Yeah, we have lots of kicks. Yeah. Yeah.
It switches between one kick or the other.
Yeah, it depends upon where you are on the field and where the opponents are. So it gets more complicated.
Yes.
Our kind of program for this kind of behavior starts to get long. But I mean, our walk actually is omnidirectional. So what we can actually do is the dog can do any arbitrary rotation and translation with its leg by moving its leg in the right way. So what you can do is, if you think about it, to go forward, if I think about the locus of my feet, they're just doing these rectangles parallel to my body. So what happens is this and this do a rectangle, and that propels me forward, and then this does another one. Now, if I want to turn, what I do is these legs are kind of doing this, and the other legs are doing the opposite thing, and that's spinning me. Okay, that's a spin. And if I want to do a sidestep, then each of my legs are just kind of doing this, right? So my legs are kind of doing this, and I'm going to sidestep. Now, by doing an arbitrary combination of these things, then I can do an arbitrary combination of turn as well as translation. So the robots can actually, you know, given this ball, it can actually do, instead of kind of having to walk, turn, it can actually do this right away. So.
Do they talk to each other and say, for example, that you should run to the ball?
Yeah, that's important, yeah. Yeah, so now we have a wireless Ethernet between these dogs. So we're not allowed to use an external computer, but they can actually use multicast IP to talk to each other, actually. So they actually multicast UDP packets saying, I'm going for the ball, you better, you know, don't come toward the ball, because otherwise we'll fight for it.
Can our team listen to that?
Oh, you're not allowed to eavesdrop. And you have you have rate control, too. So you know, you're not allowed to use up all the bandwidth of the communications so the other team can't talk. So. Question.
So, this is this at all related to how a neural organism would switch behaviors, or is it just a way that people know how to implement?
This is the only way people really know how to implement. Kind of interesting.
Do you have any ideas for how you add neural
more
inspired?
Yeah. So let me. So this is kind of what we would like to do with kind of algorithms. So the idea is, kind of our sensory system is this very high dimensional system. You know, all the pixels of our retinal photoreceptors and the the audition, you know. So you have this high dimensional sensor space, and you have these many degrees of freedom in the actuation, right? We have, you know, for legs, all these muscles that we're controlling. But the idea is, as I showed, is on the sensory perception side of things, we're really interested in some kind of low dimensional representation of these high dimensional sensors. And on the motor side of things, we're also interested in kind of not having to control all these multiple degrees of freedom. We want to have some representation of that which is very low dimensional as well. But instead of kind of just taking this down to a low dimensions and taking this down to a low dimensions, what we would like to do is, behavior-wise, we want to hook up kind of what perceptual things here in this low dimensional space would relate to some low dimensional kind of higher level control of these actuators. So we wanted to look at kind of algorithms that automatically do this kind of dimensionality reduction on one side as well as this side, as well as kind of correlate these behaviors to each other.
Is this because you're really an engineer and you want to understand every step in the process? Suppose you're not concerned about if you can understand the engineer, then probably you can actually just map the sensory to actuation.
What? No, you can. That's how you understand. You have to reduce the dimensionality.
If you want to understand the intermediate state, yes. But
suppose you have understanding. The point is, if you see various angles of Al Gore's face and then you have to go and shake his hand, bam. You want to first reduce the dimensionality and say, hey, it's Al Gore, even though it's rotated. And then you have to go, I have to shake his hand, even though his hand may be here, 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 or there. So you have to then we like shake hand, and then you have to do this high dimensional sort of thing, right? So
I mean, sensory motor mapping can be very complex, and you don't necessarily understand.
Okay. Yeah. So I'll show you kind of people. Okay. So people
that have been modeling perception.
Sure. Understand, yeah. So people have tried this. Okay. That.
But you cannot. Each of those spaces are bigger than the lifetime of the universe, because these are all possible. Pixel values for three-dimensional
space. You can have very intricate, very delicate, very complex mapping.
You cannot. That's what I'm telling you. Each of those spaces will take you more time than the lifetime of the universe. So to establish a mapping between the two, which is even a bigger problem, will never be accomplished unless you reduce the dimensionality of it.
So I'll give an example from robotics. So some people are interested in what's known in robotics as end-to-end learning. What they want to do is just take the sensor readings and take whatever high-level these actuator things and just map them directly. Okay. And so what they're trying to do is take training data where a human controls some very complicated thing, and then they have some points in here mapped directly to some points in here. Okay. And what they find is that you can't The only way you do this is if, say, a multi-layer perceptron. What they do is they do a bottleneck. They do a small set of nodes, which goes from this high dimensions to a smaller set of nodes to here. So in some sense, they're trying to learn this problem by going through a smaller bottleneck, which allows you to do generalization very well. Okay, so generalization can be incredibly hard because you have so much. Your spaces are so large, and the data that you can take is only very a couple points. And unless you hold on, this is my wife saying, "Are you done?" Okay, hold on. Okay, that's it. So let me just show you kind of the algorithms that we're interested in doing this kind of mapping. And so instead of showing you sensor to motors, which is very hard to represent, I'm going to show you images to images, just so that you can pictorially see how these types of algorithms work. And so here again, the idea is I have some image, and it's under different, in this case, we're doing a three-dimensional rotation. So it's under different poses. And then I have another object here, this teapot, which again is pictured under different rotations. And the idea is you have a couple correspondences. You know that this pose corresponds to this pose of this object, and this pose corresponds to this object, but you only given a few of these, and you want to kind of know how to map this image manifold onto this image manifold generically. Okay. So this is kind of the what we would call kind of an image correspondence problem, of mapping two different image manifolds onto each other so that we can map high-dimensional sets to other high-dimensional sets. So Lawrence Saul actually did a search on the web to see if he could get training data for things like this. So he found, actually, if you go to www.bushorchimp.com, someone's actually done this correspondence between these two different characters. So it's just to show you that this kind of correspondence problem is kind of an interesting problem. We're not actually using this data, but
that's the ground truth.
So the basic idea is, like, I have these images of, say, one object at different poses, and I have another set of images of another object at different poses, and I can think about putting these into some kind of matrix again. So each of these columns here corresponds to images of one object, and each of these columns here corresponds to images of the other object. And what's happening here is that each column here corresponds to some column here. That means that I know that they're at the same pose. And then, but then I have other data, which is images of this other object with no known correspondence on this side. And I have images of this object with no known correspondence on that side. Okay? So this is kind of, I can just represent my big data set, which is two very disparate image sets, as just these columns located in this matrix with unknown entries here and unknown entries here. That's the way we look at this problem. So the basic.
Does everything have to be at the same scale, or is that put in as a multiplicative matrix?
No, this is just actually we took one object and took pictures of it at different rotations, but we didn't.
All was at the same scale.
This particular one I'm showing you, we just did it with the same scale, but we've done other things now where we had scale as well as rotation involved. So now we have kind of a slightly more complicated manifold that we're mapping onto each other.
Do you need a separate set of images for each scale and each rotation, or can you do that multiplicatively so that you have a scale factor and a rotation factor?
Yeah, so the question is, how much data do you need to really figure this out? And I mean, the idea is kind of with more prior knowledge, the less data you need. So kind of if I kind of know that there's this, you know, two dimensions here, one is scale, one is rotation, then kind of by mapping it into two dimensions, I don't need to fill up every single point in that space so well. So the question here is kind of, how, can we do this in a very what's known in the machine learning community as a supervised learning? That is, just think of it as a regression problem. That is, I give you this data, and I give you some points, some images here which have these corresponding images. Can I train some kind of regression model that goes from here to here, and just apply that regression to map me from here to here? Okay, and then in the vice versa direction, I can take this data and think of that as a mapping like this, and then just take this set and map it up into here. That's kind of a standard regression model that you would see in statistics. Now the problem with this is D's here. This dimensionality is huge, and the number of points you have here might be very small. Okay, so you might have in images, you know, a couple hundred dimensions here, a couple hundred dimensions here. You might only have 10 images that are in correspondence. Okay, so kind of if I think of what's going to happen now is if I try to do this. So this is kind of taking this kind of multi-layer perceptron model, doing backprop on just a small training set with these small number of points in this very high dimensional spaces, what you'll get is kind of that, you know, given this, so you train this, you know, regression model, you've given this input, you're trying to deduce what this picture looks like, and you're going to get things that look like this. And if you try to do it from here to here, you get things that look like this. And the problem here is that you have such a small training set, and you're not using anything, and when you do a regression, you're not using any ideas that there's kind of an underlying manifold that you're mapping onto each other. That's completely gone. And so the generalization performance of this kind of procedure gets very bad. So the way we treat the problem is as kind of, we want to use everything, given, you know, these things and these things and these things, and knowing that kind of that there's some low dimensional representation that embodies this high dimensional data, you want to use that information in constructing these mappings. And so from a machine learning perspective, there's something called the expectation maximization algorithm, which allows you to handle this kind of missing data in this type of model very well. So the simplest model, I won't go through it, it's use principal component, the simplest linear model that we can use is you can use principal components analysis with this missing data, and then what you get is, given this input, you're trying to predict what this corresponding object looks like, and you get things that look like this. And you get these funny ghost images because you're modeling the two different manifolds. If you think about principal components, is just two linear subspaces, and you're taking two linear subspaces and putting them on top of each other. And obviously, a rotation is not a linear subspace. Okay. So what we would really like to be able to do is to take two nonlinear manifolds like this, and we know that kind of this corner corresponds to that corner, say this corner corresponds to that corner, this corner corresponds to this, this corresponds to that, and take both of these nonlinear things, map them down into a two-dimensional common space so that given a point here, we can find the corresponding low-dimensional representation and come back up into this nonlinear manifold. So we can do this taking this locally linear embedding algorithm that we talked, that I showed you before, and we just modify it slightly to have two different data sets. You learn a reconstruction weight separately for the two different data sets, and then you learn a common a low-dimensional representation by doing this quadratic optimization. What happens is this is, again, just a couple simple spectral decompositions that you do for this, and this is what you can get. You can actually then take your data, given this object, input object, you can come up with this image that corresponds very well to what it should really look like. And given this, you know, you get all the different rotations corresponding to these, you get a mapping between these and these, and a mapping between these and these. And so using this nonlinear manifold structure of the data, we can easily take this very apparent high dimensional two image data sets and stick them together so that we can go back and forth between the two. All right, so this is kind of all I wanted to show you today. And just to summarize, I talked about how kind of learning algorithms can be important in biological systems for sensory motor processing. Can we take some of those same ideas and apply them to artificial engineered systems? And I showed here that kind of that this idea that there's kind of low dimensional representations of both the sensory side of things and the motor side of things might be important, and how we can develop algorithms that can kind of discover these latent types of structures and be able to deduce kind of behaviors based upon these types of representations. And of course, there's still a lot of room for improvement. As you know, if you take a look at still these kind of robot soccer matches, there's still a lot of things that you look at and you say, oh, geez, why did that robot do that at that time? So we're still a long ways away in terms of really truly being able to develop and learn kind of interesting behaviors. So thanks a lot.
The real control for the puppy play is to have real puppies do it. Seeing how well you do compared to that.
I don't know. It'd be pretty hard to train puppies to play soccer, I think.
The point is that probably you're already doing better.
You mean to compare puppies? But I mean, so it's kind of hokey. But you know, the stated goal of this robot soccer thing is, by the year 2050, they're supposed to field some team of robots that's going to play the World Cup Human Soccer Championship on a real field and see how they do. That's their stated goal. But
those robots are hard, so if they bang into a human, that would hurt.
yeah, there probably would have to be some rules on how padded these things have to be.
But yeah, and so speaking of comparisons, it's just out of humbleness that you didn't tell us what is Italian game the final really.
Okay, so yeah, no, we actually ended up losing 4-3 in that game. So we came in second out of 24 that year. So, but that was actually my first year doing it. So that was a good experience for us. But I mean, a lot of these things, you know, when you get into kind of actually engineering it, and you have, you know, 2 days to do it before you actually have to do some actual match, then kind of you don't have time to do everything, you know, well principled learning algorithms, of course. So of course, it's like these last minute hacks that you do to do that. But so in general, though, we would like to be able to kind of take some research things with in terms of learning algorithms and really apply them to a real scenario like this, instead of having to, like these state machines, right? They're all hand engineered, and this is what people do. They tweak things, and these stories, you know. So I showed you this color segmentation to do the visual processing. I mean, that simplifies things a lot. So these stories where, like the U.S., the Army sponsor, Army and Navy and Defense Department in the U.S., they sponsor a lot of these robot types of development. And so there's stories where they have these demos, where these researchers from some university have to do a demo outside. So they want to do robots, autonomous robots outside. And so the problem is sometimes they rely on this color segmentation, most of them. And so they get to some test site, and it hasn't rained for like the last week, and you know, they rely upon the grass being green. So you hear this story where they spray paint the grass before they do their demo to actually get their color segmentation to work. So you hear very, you know, things that, you know, are not quite intelligent in terms of these.
In this software, let's suppose that you want to go to a larger field, instead of 5 meters, say 50 meters,
yeah,
size. What would be the problem? The problem is the perspective you have to
Okay, so there'd be quite a few problems. One thing, the ball
would be smaller.
It'd be like one pixel at the end of the field. Okay, so then you really have to do some behavior where the thing has to search efficiently in the field to find the ball, say. And you know, you have to communicate that with your teammates so that you know where things are. And at a large field like that, you know, you have limited resolution on the camera. And also too, if you do it outdoors, the killer thing with vision outdoors is variable lighting. So the sun goes behind a cloud, and from the perspective of a camera, again, this invariance, what happens is the colors shift completely, right? And so if you're relying upon some, you know, some kind of color space to say that this is the ball, this is the goal, and the sun goes behind the cloud and suddenly all the colors look different, it's really bad for in a robot setting. And it's incredible that we do it so well in terms of being able to do this color adaptation, lighting adaptation, all this kind of stuff that we take for granted is very difficult once you try to actually do it on a robot. All right, thanks a lot, Tom.